Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In the summer of 1985, then-President Ronald Reagan addressed the nation about the TWA hostage crisis. A hot mic caught the most powerful man in the world saying that he was happy he'd watched Rambo the night before, because then he would know what to do the next time this happens. That speaks to the power of action movies. It's also just one of the many fascinating facts that Nick Desemlian shares in his book, The Last Action Heroes, The Triumphs, Flops, and Feuds of Hollywood's Kings of Carnage. These heroes include Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Bruce Willis. And forgive me for saying this, but Nick's book is very action-packed. It goes behind the scenes of Hollywood's most muscular era.
It hasn't ended, but for me, I think the peak is really the years that I chronicle in this book, which I guess from the late 70s to about the mid-90s, when these guys were, these action heroes, these stars were really at their absolute zenith and just cranking out these iconic films, which people still love today, and they're still inspiring sequels and remakes. So that kind of 20 years, which was like a kind of cinematic arms race.
Cinematic arms race. I love that description. Yeah. There are basically two main characters who made action movies popular. The first, of course, is Sylvester Stallone. How did Stallone turn his rags to riches story into Hollywood history?
Well, his story is kind of incredible, and it was really interesting to chronicle because he really, really struggled for a long time. It's almost unbelievable. It's almost like a Dickens novel, like what he went through to get to where he went. You know, he was basically living on the streets of New York. He had no money. He had no breaks. He was playing these tiny roles in, you know, he's in the Woody Allen film Bananas. He was playing muggers. And I think if you looked at him then, he would seem like the least likely person to become who he ended up becoming. But he got there through sheer force of will. It's almost like watching one of his own movies. He got there through writing, you know, through writing the Rocky script and then refusing to let anyone else star in it. And I kind of start his story with him in Central Park Zoo, where he worked for a while. You know, the lions were peeing on him. And it's just, it's almost unbelievable, the kind of the degradation that he went through on his way to being this giant A-lister.
How did critics react to Rocky when it was released in November 1976?
They reacted favorably, really. Even Pauline Kael, you know, the critic, had she lived to see most of the films that I write about in this book, would not have given them good reviews. But even she was impressed by Rocky. And it was a real turning point. It was coming off the back of a lot of very grim, glum 70s movies. And it was this very charming, inspiring story that really came out of nowhere.
It really don't matter if this guy opens my head either. Because all I want to do is go the distance. Nobody's ever gone the distance with Creed. And if I can go that distance, you see, and that bell rings and I'm still standing, I'm going to know for the first time in my life, you see, that I weren't just another bum from the neighborhood.
It made $117 million when it came out, which was a vast amount. It was more than Taxi Driver, Carrie, and Network put together. That were some of the other films nominated for Oscars. It was more even than a big box office hit. It was this pop cultural phenomenon, this juggernaut that kind of Rocky Balboa immediately became this iconic character. You know, even though the original Rocky doesn't have like a pure happy ending, he doesn't win the final fight. People kind of tend to forget that. It was something that kind of made you want to cheer. And that was in short supply at that time. So I think that was a big reason why it punched through. No pun
Absolutely. Intended. Yeah, very well said. And I like the punch through. Very good. The flip side to the Stallone coin is Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's about as far away from Stallone's bookishness as possible, but he did have a similar rags to riches story. How did Arnold take over America?
Well, he just came to America and he was not going to accept any no's. He came with a list of things he wanted to do. Becoming a big Hollywood star was just one entry on his list, and he just methodically kept going. I mean, it's kind of amazing because the first thing that he took over was his body. Like, he started with a regular body and he just decided he was going to transform it. And he did methodically create these gargantuan muscles. I mean, if you look at pictures of him from like the late 60s and 70s, it's like he's an alien. He's so muscly and so huge. And so, you know, he came to America and he was like, right, I'm going to do that again, but I'm going to do that with my career. But he was so incredibly smart, and I think people underestimate his intelligence, but, you know, he made a lot of money for himself in real estate before he got into acting.
What you find so entertaining happens to be my life.
You're not just my hero, you're everybody's hero. And it'll all be okay again. Trust me.
No, Danny. It's getting harder. But I kept getting involved in these crazy adventures. But the craziest part is, I kept surviving.
I spoke to his acting coach at the time, who was training him, and Arnold was thinking about becoming a serious actor, and he was doing these very serious acting exercises. And then at a certain point, he decided, I'm going to become an action star. And I think a big part of that was just he saw that was where he was going to make the most money. And he was very upfront about, I'm going to make money. When he set his mind to something, he just went ahead and did it.
Yeah. Stallone and Schwarzenegger had their very own War of the Roses. How did their ongoing feud shape Hollywood and action movies?
Well, it was a literal War of the Roses, really, because it started with an unbelievable story in which Stallone picked up a bowl of flowers at the Golden Globes, I think it was 1976, and lobbed it in Schwarzenegger's direction. So they already disliked each other at that point, or certainly Stallone disliked Schwarzenegger at first glance. And it just intensified from there as it went into the 80s and then even into the 90s. They couldn't stand each other. They obviously were extremely competitive at the box office, but it spilled over into interviews where you would have Schwarzenegger talking about how much he hated Stallone's fur coats that he used to wear in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And they'd make fun of each other, each other's films. And there's a kind of a now legendary story about Stop or My Mum Will Shoot, which is the absolutely abysmal Stallone comedy that now famously Schwarzenegger pretended he wanted to do himself to kind of trick Stallone into taking it and then admitted it after the fact. It was real. I mean, they're friends now and have appeared in films together, but back then it was a very, very intense, real feud.
Yeah. How exactly did they become friends?
Through money. How else? It was Planet Hollywood that brought them together. Yeah. 1991, I think Arnold was making Terminator 2, and they came to him, the people behind Planet Hollywood, and said, do you want to come on board? Bruce Willis came on board, and then Stallone finally came on board. And so they all kind of had a big stake in Planet Hollywood, and they would promote the hell out of it. And Planet Hollywood was absolutely huge back then, but they would fly around Schwarzenegger and Stallone in private jets, and it was through that experience that they started actually talking and realizing they were actually quite similar, which is often the way. When two people hate each other, often they realize that they actually have lots in common.
Exactly.
Part of me wishes that they had formed an alliance earlier, because it would have been really great to see. They didn't end up starring in films together until they were a bit past their prime, but I would have loved to have seen something in the 80s with the two of them together. It would have been amazing.
Yeah. President Ronald Reagan was such a fan of Stallone's Rambo series that he received the nickname Ronbo. How did Rambo and other action movies impact the political climate of the era?
Yeah, I mean, I have a whole chapter on this. It's fascinating because
it
I
is.
Can't think of another example where you have a serving president of the United States being so friendly with a star, but he really would. He was quoting Rambo. There's that famous moment where he was dealing with a crisis, a sort of terrorist hostage situation, and he said, you know, I should have watched Rambo and seen what he would have done. They were friends, and I spoke to the director of Rambo 3, which is the biggest and kind of most insane of the Rambo films. That's the one where he goes to Afghanistan and kind of fights with the people who would turn out to be the Taliban against the Russians. The director of that film, Peter McDonald, told me that Stallone would get calls on set while he was dressed in his Rambo costume from Reagan, and they would be discussing American foreign policy while Stallone would kind of be standing there holding a machine gun or bazooka. Wow. They were really close. Reagan would show these big action movies in the White House, and you can't help but think he must have been a bit affected by what he was seeing in them, because, you know, you've got his friend waging war against the Russians when he kind of wasn't allowed to do it himself. It's a really fascinating dynamic. Other action stars too, they kind of tend to lean Republican. And you had Chuck Norris as well, you know, certainly a huge fan of Reagan and doing these Vietnam movies where he was kind of giving Vietnam happy ending and restaging this war. So it's really interesting, the crossover between real politics and what they were doing on screen.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's talk about the 1988 action film Die Hard. This was Bruce Willis's breakout movie. There were several other actors who were considered to play John McClane, but none of them had Willis's vulnerability. How did Bruce reshape the action hero?
You can't overstate what an impact Die Hard had. It's incredible. I can't think of another genre where you have one film come along and just completely change the course of what everyone else is doing. And you're right. It was Richard Gere. It was Clint Eastwood, Arnold. They were sending the Die Hard script out to everyone. And no one wanted to do it, which they found surprising, but it was because they thought this character was weak. John McClane is this NYPD cop, and he's got a gun, but he spends a lot of the movie running away from the terrorists, and he's hiding in air vents, and he's... at one point he cries. And these were things that just didn't happen in the action movie. This definitely didn't happen in Rambo, didn't happen in Commando. These movies were all so predicated on strength and invulnerability. And then suddenly you had a character come along that was vulnerable.
Tell her that that she is the best thing that ever happened to a bum like me. She's heard me saying I love you 1,000 times. She never heard me say I'm sorry. And I want you to tell her that, Al. I want you to tell her that John said that he was sorry. Okay? You got that, man?
Yeah, I got it, John.
But you can tell her that yourself.
And it's a really incredible bit of acting from Bruce Willis. Especially if you compare it to Rambo 3, which has quite a similar scene where you've got the hero kind of stitching himself up after he's been injured. He just does it effortlessly, Rambo, and doesn't flinch or anything. But you've got this moment where he's in real pain, but he's also in real emotional pain. And it's a really moving bit of acting from Willis as he's on the phone to his wife. It's a really great scene.
Yeah. And we've kind of talked about this already, but I want to specifically ask you about what you say in your book is that Die Hard had a seismic impact on the action genre as the 1980s turned into the 90s. Can you tell us about that? Some of it involved just kind of copying Die Hard, but there was a little more to it than that, right?
It was two things. First of all, it was the structure of the film. Die Hard set this very clean template for the action movie, which is your hero is on his own. He's in a contained space of some kind, and he's got this group of villains who are menacing him, who he's got to kind of outwit in a kind of game of cat and mouse. And then you've got a variety of henchmen, each of whom has got a different personality, headed up by an actor who generally ended up being a British actor. I guess we sound more sinister. But obviously, Alan Rickman's Hans Gruber, playing, you know, he's playing a German character, but Alan Rickman, it was his first film, and it's an amazing, iconic performance as this kind of elegant, well-spoken terrorist who's quoting Plutarch. And then you had that, and then that was repeated in you know, you had Under Siege, which basically put that on a battleship. You had Die Hard 2, which did that in an airport. You know, you have Die Hard on every mode of transport you can imagine. And still, I think Dolph Lundgren recently did a movie that was described as Die Hard at a gig, and it was him as a drummer in a musical concert that's taken over by terrorists. So they're still trying to find new wrinkles to that formula. But the second way was, as I kind of said before, was the actual action hero themselves. And Bruce Willis, I wouldn't say he's got an average build. He's like a muscly guy, but he definitely was less formidable looking than Arnold or Sly at that time. It really made Die Hard super effective because you really worry for him because he looks like an ordinary guy. And then I think that just set the template that you then had Keanu Reeves, you had Wesley Snipes, you had all these guys in the 90s who were much more relatable guys. They weren't these giant, muscly gym guys. They were people you could relate to that kind of looked like us. And they were put into these impossible situations and often they were vulnerable. But even Stallone, he did Cliffhanger, which is Die Hard on a mountain. And that movie starts with him being responsible for someone falling to their death. And he's tormented by it. He's kind of got PTSD. And that's something you don't really see in any of his action movies. I mean, I guess Rambo has got PTSD, but he is also increasingly invulnerable. But you started to see even Arnold and Sly would start playing these vulnerable characters, which was a huge shift.
Definitely. Very well said. We talked about Schwarzenegger. We talked about Stallone and about Bruce Willis. And you write about many other action heroes. Do you have a favorite, one that we didn't talk about that you find particularly fascinating?
I love Jackie Chan. I think he does amazing things that frankly no human should do again and again. I don't know how he's alive, but he has such a fearsome commitment to action. He's dedicated his entire life to it and risked his life many times over. I loved kind of diving into his oeuvre for the book and watching these amazing films like Police Story, Police Story 3, which is absolutely amazing. He teams up with Michelle Yeoh in that. Armour of Gods. I mean, there are just so many. He's absolutely incredible. And I really loved writing about him as well, just his arc that he was trying to break into Hollywood several times and it just kept going wrong. And then finally it was Stallone who actually kind of invited him over to Hollywood and kind of facilitated his breakthrough finally. And that was another joy of writing the book, was just kind of learning how all of these different guys connected in different ways.
Anyway, where the hell did you learn to kick like that?
Jackie Chan movies.
Sometimes feuds, but sometimes they would really support each other. And the Stallone-Jackie Chan story is a really good one.
What is the current state of the action movie genre?
It's evolving, I think. On the one hand, you've got all the superhero movies, the Marvel and DC things, which are these big, sometimes bloated productions with loads of VFX. And then on the other hand, you've got movies like John Wick, basically taking it back to basics. And I think they're trying to recapture the essence of what these movies were doing. So kind of real stunts and martial arts and trying to make it more practical. They still have VFX in them. But yeah, I think it's obviously the superhero movie has taken over and become the equivalent of what Rambo and the Terminator films were back then. But I think there's a real hunger for these movies. That there's definitely a hunger for stuff which evokes the 80s. Because I think, like I said, it was this golden era. So I think you saw Top Gun Maverick become this huge box office smash. And again, it was Tom Cruise doing real practical stuff in planes. And Tom Cruise and Keanu Reeves are kind of at the forefront of that, doing real stunts and going to great lengths to show that they did the real stunts. These guys, like I said, Sly and Arnold, they were doing real stuff back then. And I think people want that. I think people miss that.
Yeah. Nick DeSemlian, congratulations on The Last Action Heroes. It's a fascinating analysis of the action movie genre.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Nick DeSemlian is the author of The Last Action Heroes, The Triumphs, Flops, and Feuds of Hollywood's Kings of Carnage. Find out more about Nick and your favorite action heroes at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Bobcat Goldthwaite, Megan Abbott, and Nick DeSemlian.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's fantastic. This is his best performance ever.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Welcome to the party, pal!
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I mean, who am I kidding? I ain't even in the guys' league.